The Battle for Liberty, Episode 2. This is the Battle for Liberty. And welcome to the Battle for Liberty. I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Welcome to the only libertarian podcast dedicated to the journey of the novice. This is your libertarian show for the regular Joe, your training wheels for the liberty movement. As always, check us out at battleforliberty.com. Follow us on Twitter at @MyBattleLiberty and email me at mike@battleforliberty.com. Okay, some recent updates. Every show has a show notes page. I don't know if I mentioned that the last week, but we do have a show notes page for every episode, and we make it very easy for you to access it by navigating over to battleforliberty.com/, and then the show number. So for this episode number 2, it would be battleforliberty.com/2. That'll automatically take you to the page that has all of the articles that I've referenced, books that I've referenced, and any notes about any guests that I speak to. All right, next, the show is now available in both the iTunes podcast store as well as on Stitcher. So no matter what device you have, you can easily access the show. So please, if you like what you hear, make sure you're subscribed on one of those services. Really helps me out. Spread the word, share the show, tell a friend, help me distribute the message. All right, since we last talked last week, it has been a busy week. I really can't believe it's Friday already, but here it is. A quick note, I'll be traveling next week, and it may be difficult for me to get a show recorded due to the jam-packed work week that I'm going to have while I'm out of town. These business trips, you know how they go. It's fly in, work all day, group dinners at night, you go straight to bed, and then rinse and repeat the next day. You know, couple that with a double layover flight from California to Florida, spending the day in Florida and then jetting back home to the middle of the country on Friday. It's gonna be a long week. So needless to say, I may not get an episode recorded, but I'm gonna do my best. We'll just have to see when it happens. Okay, on to a new segment of the show that I'm calling Libertarian Life. This is a segment of the show where I'm going to highlight an everyday run-of-the-mill scenario that you may tilt your head to the side and think, boy, something's just not right there, but you just don't know what it is. And I'm going to do my best to point out some of these situations and highlight for you the libertarian themes that are present hiding behind the scenes. So our first libertarian life example is just the other night, sitting at home, the kiddos have gone to bed, I'm sitting with my wife, we're going over some financial records for an organization that she belongs to, and we hear a pretty loud truck operating outside in our street, and that's really odd for where we live. We live on a back street, not next to, or at least in the front of our house, it's not a big thoroughfare. And so my wife assumes, well, it must be a street cleaner, but sure didn't sound that way to me. So I decided I'd get up, go to the door, walk outside, and take a look. Well, I can see what looks like a utility truck slowly moving through the neighborhood, complete with the requisite flashing amber caution lights. Where would we be without amber caution lights, right? As the truck approaches our property, I can see that there's a large nozzle on the back of the truck, and as it drives by, this nozzle is spraying a fine mist into the air all over the properties in the area, including our own. And so I decide to get a little closer and get a glimpse of the lettering on the side of the truck, and sure enough, it says mosquito control. And it looks and has all the markings of a government vehicle. And so, of course, I think to myself, you've got to be kidding me. Add this to the ever-growing list of services that we're forced to finance, whether they're wanted or not. So this gets to the heart of some property rights issues. Have I given my permission to the town to spray chemicals on my property? Do I even know what these chemicals are? Are they safe? Are they effective? I have no clue. But here's the state performing this vital service, trespassing with their chemical cloud all over my property. So, of course, being how my personality is, I decided to do some quick research. And it was pretty easy to find out that the town advertises this. It is their express purpose to spray for mosquitoes to help prevent the spread of West Nile virus. And Lord, are they proud of themselves. Apparently, if the local town didn't spend money on mosquito control, we'd all be dying of West Nile virus or maybe Zika. In fact, I'm quite sure that without this service, we'd all be dead right now. No, of course not. So I do some further research and I discover that in 2015, there were 108 cases of West Nile virus in all of Colorado, the state where I live. Of those cases, 44 of them were of the type that simply exhibit a fever and go away within a few weeks. However, 57 of the cases involved what they call the neuroinvasive strain, and that simply means that it either involved meningitis or encephalitis. Now, neither of those conditions are good, but they're not always fatal, and you know how I know that? Because of those 57, only 3 people died in Colorado in 2015 from West Nile virus. Now, I'm sure you're sitting there thinking, going, oh my God, it killed 3 people? Well, yeah, it did, but I don't really know anything about those people. Were they already compromised in some way with their health? Were they extremely elderly? Were they very young? There's no way for me to know that. But what I do know is that Colorado has a population of about 5.35 million people. And so when you do the math, you find that 1/1000th of 1%, so not 1%, but 1/1000th of 1%, were infected with the neuroinvasive form of West Nile virus. And furthermore, 5/100,000th of 1% actually succumbed to the disease and died. Those are some small numbers. I'm really not concerned about those numbers. But we have to be fair and we have to ask, well, are those low numbers of the disease a result of the state's efforts, their mosquito control policies, or would those numbers be low on their own? Well, I don't know. I looked for those numbers and, I couldn't find the data readily. But as I was looking for the data, it dawned on me, hey, here's the point. Does anyone even care to know whether the state's program is efficient? Or are you just happy to have the state carry on its merry way, spend your money without you ever knowing if the efforts are yielding results in your favor? Unfortunately, the answer I get from most people is the latter. Of course, they'd much rather live inside the matrix in complete ignorant bliss. And of course, this is just how the state takes control. This is exactly where they want you. And yet, the ignorant masses will turn around and complain about the very government that they empower with their own stupidity and lack of participation. In fact, some local hens were recently clamoring on and on and on a local social media network about how the government just isn't doing enough about the mosquitoes on the 4th of July. Heaven forfend, you get a bug bite on the 4th of July. Quick, turn around, complain to daddy government. After all, isn't that the purpose of the government? To take care of us? Please, Mr. and Mrs. Status, the next time you want to complain about a government service, about its inefficiency, its lack of your particular brand of coercion, save it. The government is inefficient and stupid because you are lazy and careless. You're too lazy to think for yourself, and you're so careless that you don't even know every time you assign a responsibility to the state, you lose an equal amount of your own autonomy, your ownership of yourself. Remember, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, and it is no different with state control. And that's our libertarian life moment for this week. So now I'd like to move on and discuss some popular news items. And of course, we can't talk about the news, this being the second week of July in 2016, without talking about police shootings. There were several that were nationally covered, lots of activity with the police and violence with the police. And so I'd like to go there. And before we talk about it, I want to say first and foremost that I wasn't there. It's likely you weren't there. None of us who are listening to this were there. Regardless of any video that you've seen, any video that's available to us, so far, most of it doesn't show the whole picture. So I do not want to jump to conclusions based on emotion. And emotions are high in these cases. I can tell you I have been emotionally charged because what I've seen. These are incomplete videos, but they have the ability to easily sway our opinion simply because they're so tragic. When something horrific happens in front of you and you see it and you experience it as a human being, we seek to quickly find reasons why it happened. We cannot deny in this case, though, that these heightened emotions are playing a role in skewing our rational thought. So the goal here is to analyze the situation absent from emotion, and it's a difficult task, but we've got to try. So let's briefly recap what's happened over the last week or so. I'm going to start with the case of Alton Sterling. This is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. In this case, an anonymous caller reports that there's a man outside a convenience store wearing a red shirt and he's selling CDs, and he apparently threatened this anonymous caller with a gun. That's the report. So police respond, they arrive, and they confront the man. And at some point, a bystander begins recording video from a cell phone, something I always recommend. If you see an encounter with the police, record it. It's going to be important one day. So from the video, it could appear that the police almost immediately tackle the man. But again, let's take a step back and realize that we don't know when that video began recording. Okay, so let's be fair about this. I don't know if it's immediate, but from the video, it happens pretty quickly. We'll reserve judgment for later on that. But what we do know from the video is that a struggle ensues between the police and Mr. Sterling. And in the struggle, he's taken to the ground. I've read a report that he was tased. I don't see that, but maybe I'm just missing. Maybe I'm blatantly missing it. At the end of the day, he's taken to the ground. While the officers are struggling with him, you can hear someone, presumably one of the police officers, shout, "He's got a gun." And at that point, the officer removes his firearm from his holster, points it directly at Mr. Sterling's chest, point blank. They continue to struggle a little bit. It's very difficult to see, and this is the problem with some videos. You can see the top portion of Mr. Sterling, you can see the lower part of his legs, but you can't see his hands and you can't see his pockets, and those are the two areas that are going to become pretty crucial in what's about to transpire. As they're struggling, you pretty quickly hear the distinct noise of what sounds like gunfire. And it's at that point that the first video turns away and you can no longer see anything, but you can still hear. And what you hear is approximately 4 more shots. And Mr. Sterling died from his wounds. The police, shot him several times and he died. And the video is disturbing in and of itself, if for no other reason that you're witnessing the death of a human being. That's not easy to take. I don't care who you are. But a second video has surfaced, and this from the perspective of the convenience store owner, and this one actually does show quite a bit more graphic violence. You could actually see Mr. Sterling bleeding as he's dying, and that one really takes me back a bit. So that's the first example, and I'm not going to comment yet on the macro issues here. I'm just going to move on to the second issue. This is several days later, and this is a suburb outside of Minneapolis, and it's the case of Philando Castile. And the following account of what happened is, as far as I can tell, a third-party piece of information. So as I've said, I've got to take into account that this is someone else's account of what happened. This all happened before the video started. So the report is that there's a traffic stop for some sort of non-moving violation, and Mr. Castile is the driver. It's reported that the traffic violation is an equipment problem of some sort, a bad taillight. I've read some reports that the violation is being disputed, that maybe there wasn't a bad taillight. I don't know. It's very difficult to know for sure. We see, or we know rather, we don't see this, but we know that Castile is approached by the police officer, and that Castile subsequently informs the police officer that he was carrying a firearm and that he was licensed to carry a concealed firearm with a valid permit. That's the claim that's made in the video. The video also claims that the officer asked him to produce his driver's license, and that Castile tells the officer he's reaching for his license, at which point the officer shoots Castile 4 times for reasons that are still unknown to me. Of course, the officer claims Castile was reaching for his weapon, but without further evidence, that's going to be difficult to confirm or deny with really any amount of certainty. Over time, I'm sure more evidence will be offered, more pieces of information will come out, and it may be a little bit easier to try to judge the situation, but I don't know that we'll ever get to a point of certainty. Now, unfortunately, Castile succumbs to his wounds as well, and he dies. The worst part about this is that the aftermath of this is caught on video, and tragically, a young girl is in the back seat witnessing the entire thing. And I can only think that she will probably never fully recover from that trauma. Again, a tragic set of circumstances, a tragic video. Anytime you see the death of a human being, I don't know about you, but I'm taken aback by it. So that's example number 2 of some police violence. Now I'm going to go to a third example. Now I know you're probably thinking I need to cover what happened in Dallas in the aftermath and the 5 police officers who were killed in Dallas. That in and of itself is horrific and tragic, and violence against the police is no more permissible than violence committed by the police. So I'm going to leave it there and just know that that is not excusable. But for the purposes of the point that I'm making, I want to move on to another example that's actually from September of 2014. It's a little bit older, and you may not know about it, but I just happened to have this article sent to me this week, and I'm reading it and watching videos of it as I'm learning about the other 2 examples, and this is what sparked the interest in me to do my episode this week on police violence. So I'm going to take you to September 2014 to Independence, Missouri, which is a Kansas City suburb. It deals with Bryce Masters, who at the time was the 17-year-old son of a veteran police officer. And by all accounts, when you read the article, Bryce was systematically harassed, stalked, targeted, illegally detained, illegally searched, and eventually brutally punished by a vindictive police officer. And where does it all start? Well, marijuana, of course, apparently the scourge of the earth. Certainly a little dime bag is worth a 17-year-old's life, wouldn't you say? Obviously not. So it starts in the summer of 2014 when 2 hero police officers in Independence, Missouri, begin hassling this high school kid for what amounts to possession of a couple joints. An illegal search is just the beginning. In fact, an illegal search occurs a second time, with the second occurrence resulting in Bryce's arrest in August 2014 for possession of a small amount of marijuana. Now, as I've said, Bryce's father is a police officer, and he asks Bryce about the encounter, and Bryce tells him that the officer simply demanded to search his pockets with really no reason, no evidence, no reasonable suspicion. And so as a police officer, Bryce's father decide they're going to contest that. But you better be careful. You better not contest the state. We're about to find out what can happen to you. So both of those, by the way, both of those encounters involve the same 2 police officers. What a coincidence, right? Well, then in September of 2014, just a month later, one of those same officers, Officer Timothy Rummels, he's been harassing Bryce for several months now. He decides he's going to pull him over. Okay, this is not a new encounter for Officer Rummels. He knows who Bryce is. He knows his car. We'll later find out that the traffic stop seems a little bit spurious, but we'll discuss that. During the traffic stop, Bryce decides he's going to stand up for his civil liberties, stand up for his rights, and simply question the police officer on why he's been stopped and asks him, "Am I under arrest?" During this, the officer cannot believe the audacity of a mere 17-year-old citizen to stand up for himself and ask, "Why have you pulled me over? And am I under arrest?" And so the officer gets angry and opens the door and begins to try to forcibly extricate Bryce from the vehicle. And when Bryce continues to passively resist, the officer unceremoniously basically says, "F it," gets out his taser, and tases him in the chest directly for 23 seconds. Now, it's important to know that he was tased directly into the chest for an extended period of time. What happens in this particular case is that Bryce goes into cardiac arrest. And as he's going into cardiac arrest, the officer is pulling him limb from limb out of the vehicle. And the officer tells him to walk. He says, "Walk." And well, Bryce is in the middle of dying, so walking is a bit hard just then. So the hero cop decides he's going to drag Bryce's lifeless body around to the back of the car and then proceeds to drop him on the ground while handcuffed, face down, with enough force to shatter his teeth and dislocate his jaw. So Bryce is lying on the ground, choking on his own blood, drawing what could be his last breaths. And this supposed peace officer is standing over him, taunting him. Says things like, "You don't like to play by the rules, do you?" And, "I don't play games." I mean, folks, this is the very definition of horrific. Bryce is clinically dead for 8 minutes. In fact, it's several minutes of Bryce lying dead on the concrete before the officer's supervisor shows up and looks at him and says, "Yeah, he's turning blue. The EMTs better hurry up." I mean, it's just unbelievable to me. Now, by what can only be described as a miracle, Bryce is taken to the hospital. He's revived and he recovers to what I consider to be an unbelievable extent. Now, he will live the rest of his life with serious injuries to his brain and to his personality. He was just simply deprived of oxygen for far too long. He will no longer have the sort of life that he was planning on. And at this point, I've got to encourage you to go to the show notes page. That's battleforliberty.com/2. And follow the link to the article. The article is called "A Shot to the Heart." It's on a website called The Intercept, and it's by Nick Burradini and Matt Stroud. The article is long, but it's got a lot of detail that you need to read, and it has two videos. It's got the cell phone video from Bryce's own cell phone, and it's got the police dash cam video, which winds up being integral to the eventual prosecution and conviction of Officer Rummels. So Officer Rummels is eventually convicted of depriving Bryce's civil rights, and he receives 4 years in federal prison for this, which, maybe some form of justice. I'm not sure how the Masters family feels about it. They talk about that in the article. So you should go read it. It's another example of horrific police violence. And this violence is inflicted by our supposed protectors. So what you'll be told, of course, is that, well, the police respond to with violence only when threatened, right? But that's getting harder and harder to believe. You see, I have a pretty unique perspective here. I didn't mention this in my story of liberty in episode one, but it bears revealing here in this episode. I was a police officer for 5 years. I've been on that side of the equation. I've been to the police academy. I've been trained. I understand how they operate. And I can tell you with certainty that while many police officers are trying to do some good, trying to do a noble job and help their community, the authority that they are given over other human beings just doesn't come without rampant corruption and tendencies towards violent escalation. Too many times as a police officer, I saw situations that could have been de-escalated, but were not, because a certain officer, and it's not one in particular, there were a couple that I knew, would come onto the scene, and then, you know, everyone would know, well, that this could get out of hand. They are trained with a mentality that is repeated over and over again during the academy. And I want to repeat it here for you so that you really understand where this comes from. And the mentality is, well, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Now, take a minute for that to sink in. Does that sound like the attitude of a noble public servant willing to give his life for the good of the community? Or does that sound like an authoritarian who gets paid your money to lord over you? We'll talk more about my experience as a police officer in another episode. I wanna shift gears here and talk about what I think the root cause of all of this is. We've had three examples here of police violence. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, in episode one, I argue at the root of all of this is a complete and total lack of respect for private property and non-aggression. Let's talk first about drugs. Oftentimes, non-violent drug offenses can lead to unnecessary escalations into violence. How much money are we spending on this war on drugs? What effect have we been having? Folks, I can tell you, we are losing this disastrous war on drugs. And what about it being called a war? Well, with a war comes an army. And our peace officers are more and more being turned into an occupying force complete with tanks, drones, aircraft, tactical teams. The list goes on. They have chemical agents. It's an army that's policing your town. So, speaking of drugs and property, if you don't own your own body, I ask, what property do you own? Sure, you may disagree with drug use. I certainly disagree with it. I do not choose to ingest drugs. I live in a state where recreational marijuana is legal, and yet I do not participate. It's not in my best interest, I don't think. But I also don't think that I know what's in the best interest of anyone other than myself. I drink beer. Am I a horrible pariah that should be shunned and forcibly told what I can and can't do with a glass of beer? Well, we don't treat beer that way, so how can we treat other drugs that way? And of course, people will tell you that, well, with drugs comes violence, but I would say with the police comes violence. So in the final analysis today, we can only come to the conclusion that as the state monopoly on policing gets bigger and bigger, it's becoming less and less effective, less and less safe, and less within our control. So whether it's a local town who decides that mosquito prevention is in my best interest, or an occupying military police force hell-bent on keeping me from self-medicating, the state is ever-present. It is all around you and constantly working to remove your ability to govern yourself and to take your place as the decision-maker in so many aspects of your life. So let's do each other a favor. Resist whenever you feel you can. Whenever you feel it's safe, simply refuse to go along. Peaceful resistance has worked in the past and it can work again. It all starts with an awareness of the problem. And I sure hope I've provided a little bit of that for you today. Thanks so much. Until next time, battle on.